Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and this episode is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network of Shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows there. Today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Sky Keith, and by Adam Francisco to talk about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I think my dad had a pretty good idea to read through the books in the Chronicles of Narnia.
You sound so surprised.
I mean, it's not that often that even a blind squirrel finds a nut every now and then.
Wow.
We were also thinking about recording a Christmas episode this week. And, you know, as I was rereading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I sort of realized there's not a good reason to do a separate Christmas episode. This could suffice as a standalone episode and as a great episode for Christmas week, I really do think. Mostly because there, so much of the beginning of the book is actually references Christmas, is an advent in itself of the return of Aslan, and so many other things. So I think we'll be able to do that there. Before we jump into this episode, I wanted to thank everybody who helped us with our end of year, at the beginning of our end of year giving campaign with Giving Tuesday. We hit a very awesome goal of $200,000. That's our biggest goal that we've ever had in a single day. And we made it in a single day, which means I know that many of you listeners helped us out during the course of Giving Tuesday. And we're very appreciative for that. And those gifts were matched, and it was quite amazing. We have a couple weeks left to the end of the year, really like a week and a half, I guess, to the end of the year. And we have a remaining $60,000 goal for our end of year giving. If you would like to help us reach that goal, you can go to 1517.org/donate. There you can find our giving portal, which includes everything from credit card to ACH, direct from bank payment, which is handled by Plaid, a trusted service, so you don't have to hope that 1517 is seeing your bank information, and even stocks and cryptocurrency. So there's lots of options there. And again,
hey, give us your Bitcoin.
Yeah, give us your Bitcoin. It's unfortunately not one Bitcoin would make the end of the year goal this year. Bitcoin's down. What a sad day.
Bitcoin.
It's 45 today. Is that right?
Oh, no.
Sad.
But we're happy to receive gifts in whichever way is most convenient for you to give. So whether that is from investments like stock or crypto, or from hard-earned cash that you've made, we appreciate it all. And those efforts do go to keep things like the Thinking Fellows podcast going, and especially reaching new and larger audiences. We're able to use that money in our outreach and marketing campaigns for podcasts, as well as maintenance of the show. For instance, this year, the Thinking Fellows got new headsets, and Adam got equipment so that he could come back on the show. Those kinds of things happen because we have a budget provided by donors like you, and we greatly appreciate it. Okay,
right.
Guys. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Now, when you first said this, I was like, oh, man, I'm going to have to do some reading. I'm going to have to reread these.
And as then, if they're like tomes.
As if they're tomes. But, it's like it's busy. It's Christmas. We got a lot of snow. We have lots of family stuff going on. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, where am I going to...
And unlike in Narnia, for you, it's not always winter, never Christmas. Christmas fast approaches.
Christmas fast approaches. But then I started reading, and I couldn't put it down. It was like, oh, I've got to make dinner. I can get three more pages in, and things like this. It's incredibly gripping set of books for children's books, don't you think?
Yeah. No, and I think they reach far beyond just children's books, which kind of give the idea that they're... wouldn't be edifying to read as an adult, and they certainly are.
I can't remember the last time I read them before now. I've read them at least two other times, all seven books at least two other times. I think once in middle school, once in high school. So it's been quite the break from me from the series. I tend not to be a rereader except for a handful of things that I occasionally reread, some that would bore people to death. Like I reread the Odyssey too many times. These need to be in that rereading cycle. What do you think, Adam? Are you a rereader?
Well, I think that I am, but the rereading was a fast read, just to make sure I got all the nuts and bolts. Kind of reading like a what does Nestingen in say?
Like a
conquering army. Yeah, just because I my schedule's a little impacted at the year end of the semester here. But like you suggested, it's hard to speed read it because you get drawn into the story. It's sort of like Homer's Iliad, or you said the Odyssey, I guess, right? Every time I would reread that when I taught the book, I'd kind of sit down begrudgingly, but then after that first sentence, you're like, oh, actually, this is a really great story.
Yes.
So I think it's kind of telling also, I don't know who produced or paid for or what the right word is here that put out those the movies, the three Narnia movies, but that a major motion picture movie company spent all that money, and I don't know how much money they made on it, but to put together put out and produce the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Voyage of the Dawn Treader,
Prince Caspian, and Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Is it the Magician's Prince Caspian? That's it. Yeah. So these are. It's interesting. I wonder if 300 years from now. Mm-hmm. Assuming there's still we haven't died of heat death or something,
or cold death,
hit by a major comet or something. I wonder if I wonder if there will be these things will be considered part of the Western canon, if you will.
That is interesting to think about. I think so. I think actually, if you read a lot of literary analysis today, they say that there's two series that are the largest impact on the genre of fantasy as it continues to be written in fiction and displayed on screen. And that's The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit as sort of a set, and The Chronicles of Narnia. That they are the influence, the greatest influence on that genre of writing today.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, in every media, whether that's paper media like actual words, movies, television, or video games, anything that's narrative, and you can see it. I was reading one particular essay that was that Tolkien basically shaped what the modern idea of an elf in fantasy looks like. He was borrowing from Northern myth as well, but that elves weren't canonized as a race, as like tall and beautiful in other types of fantasy.
Good with a bow and arrow.
Yeah, and good with a bow and arrow. Now that's pretty universal. You can't run into a fantasy genre where the elves are too different.
Or anything different. Even that's interesting because even I haven't really paid attention to video games in a long time, but even in Legend of Zelda, wasn't Zelda an elf?
Yeah, I mean elfish, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that meets the description.
Link
does, yeah. No, it's
it's not. His name's not Zelda.
Zelda's the princess. That's how people are like screaming right now who listen to the show.
We're 8 minutes in and we're talking about Zelda and Homer, and it's fascinating.
It is interesting. These things are interwoven.
I think there's this trend out there where people, even like elf ears. Not just on Halloween, but people are walking around with elf ears and maybe getting plastic surgery to have their ears shaped that way. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen the plastic surgery, but actually when we went to Spider-Man the other day, there was a young woman walking around the theater with plastic elf ears on. I reserve all judgments for this, but...
Really, did you see your brother at the movie? The picture of your brother at the movie?
No, was he dressed up as Spider-Man?
Full Spider-Man mask.
Wow. Yeah, so... yes. But... So
dork.
Yeah, dork. So Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Let's move on. Obviously, I mean, with this... portion of the conversation establishes is that it's a great work of fiction. We tend to believe that there's going to be a huge amount of influence, and that there already exists a huge amount of influence from Lewis on the fantasy genre. But let's get into the work itself as people perhaps are picking these up alongside us, rereading them or reading them for the first time so that we can do this. Dad, do you want to explain the setting that this happens in? Because there's essentially two settings, right? There is the world we live in, and there's Narnia. And I think there is something important about the time and place in the world we live in that this starts and then moves into. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so this is Lewis sets this during the Blitz of London, where the during World War II, where the Nazis are sort of sending nightly bombing raids into London. And the Pevensey children, it seems, are residents of London who, like many, many other children of the time, get sent out to go stay in the country until the Blitz is over, because the Blitz was very effective in killing a lot of people in London, and they didn't want children to be part of that. And so the children are sent out to the country to go live in the house of who they call the professor. The professor has a house that many people believe is modeled on Lewis's, what he called their new house when he was growing up, which was the house that his father had built for them. His father was of some means by the time the kids were, you know, maybe like 9 and 10, and they had this new house built out in the country, which was very large and drafty and had lots of rooms and crazy furniture in it and books everywhere. And so they get sent out to this house in the country with the professor. And the professor is a kindly old guy who I think is probably modeled after Lewis's great teacher, the Great Knock. Mm-hmm. Because anytime they bring questions to him, they very much get a Socratic response from the professor. It's not, "Hey, professor, we think this is going on. What do you think?" He never says, "Well, this is what I think is going on." He always asks them questions back, like to analyze sort of their preconceptions of the situation.
Yeah, like, is it reasonable to believe X?
Is it reasonable to believe X?
What led you to that conclusion?
Right. And so to get the children to the place where they have an answer of their own that they can in turn own. Did you want to do like the whole breakdown, like a 2-minute breakdown of the story?
Sure. I mean, I think that, yeah.
Yeah. So eventually the youngest of the children ends up going into this wardrobe, which is in a room that they call the spare room in the professor's house. And when she goes into this wardrobe, it's full of fur coats. And the further in she goes, the more the wardrobe changes. And eventually she ends up in this wintry land of Narnia. She has an encounter with a fawn. She comes back in. She tells her brothers and sisters about it. They don't believe her. Sometime later, the second youngest child, Edmund, also makes his way, following after Lucy, into Narnia. And he finds, too, that she was right all along, that the wardrobe does lead to this wintry land of Narnia. He meets, while he's there, the White Witch. The White Witch entreats him to bring back his brothers and sisters, all of them at one time. And he eventually finds Lucy. They go back to the professor's house. And Lucy says, "Oh, I was right. Edmund knows, too." And Edmund's like, being a jerk. He's like,
"I know, she made it up.
She made it up. I don't know what you're talking about. There's only coats in that wardrobe." And then she freaks out, right? This is one of the great scenes where they do go to the professor, because they start to worry that Lucy is mad. You know, in our age, I think we'd say that she's having mental health issues.
Yeah, she's having a bout of anxiety.
An anxiety attack or something like that. But they think she's mad. So they go talk to the professor. And the professor, you know, they give him the story. Lucy says she's gone to this, through the wardrobe, to this land cart called Narnia. She says Edmund went too, and she says Edmund's lying. And he says there's nothing there. We think she's going mad. Can you help us? And he literally says, "In your experience, who is more likely to be the liar in this scenario, Lucy or Edmund?" And Peter, the oldest brother, responds, "Well, in my past experience, I would always say that Edmund is the liar 100% of the time, and that Lucy is the one telling the truth 100% of the time." And instead of the professor saying, "Yes, Lucy is mad," he basically says, "Well, then maybe you should believe her," right?
Yeah.
Through happenstance, playing essentially hiding from the housekeeper at the professor's house, who's giving a tour, because apparently his house is a place where you
want historical interest.
Where you want to come get tours. And they all go into the wardrobe. They all end up in Narnia. And then sort of ensues, I don't think we have to go through all of it, but then ensues sort of the adventure from that point on with all of the children in this land of Narnia.
Right. No, very interesting. The setting in Narnia, we should go to a couple of the things you've touched. So we have a great setting of where we are in England. We're in the country side of England.
Countryside.
We're during
the
war.
I like to believe it's the Cotswolds, don't you, Adam?
Yes, yes, with thatched roofs and
beautiful countryside outside of Oxford.
Can we pause for a second? You know, when they go into Narnia, there's that lamppost.
Mm-hmm. Yes, good point.
And I'm do you know what's this? I know it appears in, is it in The Magician's Nephew?
Mm-hmm. So in The Magician's,
but there's some significance to it, and I have no idea what it is.
In The Magician's Nephew, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but in The Magician's Nephew, Jadis, the White Witch, makes her way into London, I believe, and she has an encounter with the police and other people before she's sort of sent through this portal into Narnia, and part of her encounter is she grabs the light portion branch off of a London lamppost and pulls it off and is swinging it as a weapon. When she's taken into Narnia, or what will be Narnia, actually, when she's taken into this land that will be Narnia, the that portion of the lamppost, it lands on the ground. And when Aslan sings Narnia into existence, as everything grows, the lamppost too grows into a lamppost.
Becomes a lamppost. So,
and it does is there any significance to it being from the real world?
I think so. I mean, I think it's definitely a point of connection.
And in Narnia,
and it serves as a point of, it serves from that point on in most of the books as a, even when it's forgotten a little bit, as in the last part of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it serves as a geographical reference to where they are.
Yeah, it's the guide to where Narnia and our world meet. Which is very interesting. The lamppost is a very stark symbol when you come in. You kind of want it to mean something. It's standing there. It's even illustrated at the beginning of the chapters in a lot of the books. The other thing at the beginning of the book is when Lucy first comes into Narnia, how magical the winter is, how sort of good the winter seemingly is. It's different than where they are, where it's summer.
Well, he makes the distinction that it's different from even when they get snow, the wet snow that they get.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, he makes reference a couple times that it's crunchy and kind of, you know, how like dry snow does, kind of floats in the air.
But he quickly takes sort of this magical scene of snow falling down by a lamppost into a mystical wood and makes the winter actually something to be dreaded.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the very significant things that's very easy to overlook is that the first being that Lucy encounters in Narnia is a faun, who is essentially a being with a torso of a human, a lower half of a goat, a tail, kind of whiskers off the chin like a goat, and kind of the ears of a goat, too. And she's just like, "Hi, Mr. Fawn." You know, she's not like freaked out. And I'm sitting there thinking of your sister when she's 6 or 7 meeting a fawn, like a real fawn, and what the reaction would be. And Lucy, it's totally normal. You know, Lucy just rolls with it. She just asks him what he is, and oh, that's interesting. And then she, in our day and age, this is unheard of, and then she goes to his house for tea.
The worst part is, though, your worst fears are imagined as you're like, oh, the fawn's going to kidnap her or do something bad. And the fawn's like, begins bawling, "I'm actually here to kidnap you." You're like, no, that's why you shouldn't follow strangers to their homes.
I think there's some of the, Lewis makes some of those points there, some explicitly and not implicitly. Like, I think the fawn story is, don't follow strangers home. You know, it doesn't actually work out great for Lucy. Now, the fawn ends up becoming, you know, the fine character and everything, but still it's dangerous. The other one that I noticed that I hadn't before rereading it was how many times Lewis says in there how dumb it would be to close a wardrobe door behind you because you might get locked in. And I thought, this is such a children's book.
Yeah, no, that's very true. So the story progresses, and the notable thing about the winter becomes not how magical it is, but that it is always winter, never Christmas.
Yeah, it's cursed in the sense that there's a long suffering to it. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's not that winter is bad. Winter is good, and it's, you know, you can rejoice in winter as a season. But when there is no season but winter, there's a long suffering attached to it. And in the case of the Narnians, the long suffering is awaiting Aslan's return.
Yeah, there's, you know, up here in Big Bear, there's always something like very special about that first big snow. Not even the first sprinkling, but the first time you get a foot or more of snow.
First time you break out the snowblower.
Yeah, the blower or the shovels. But even that, if it doesn't stop after a couple of days, if it keeps snowing or it stays so cold that everything you walk on...
You're on the 15th snow blowing of the driveway.
Yeah, or it stays so cold that every piece of snow that gets even a little compacted by your foot becomes ice the next day.
Impossible to get off the driveway.
You end up exhausted because of how much work winter is to keep on living. Like, you have to remove the winter.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. We had that 8 or 10 inches or whatever it was, and somebody drove on my little auxiliary driveway here, and it's been 7 or 8 days since, and I just got the last piece of snow off it because there's some long suffering to it.
Yeah. And even when it's a winter you're looking forward to, you have to remove it for life to keep on going.
If
it can't be removed, life kind of stops.
I just gave people some insight into my old man life, that some of my obsessions are getting all the snow off my driveway.
Yeah. Good luck.
That's funny, because I was just thinking about how our last winter, so it was the first winter, real winter we experienced in over a decade, because we were living in Southern California near the beach. Then all of a sudden we're here in Chicago area, and it's, you know, for six weeks, snowing, constantly snowing, and it just builds up. It doesn't get warm enough to melt. And I spaz out every time it snows. I have to have the driveway completely cleared, and the lines on the side of the driveway have to be perfectly straight. That's maybe my OCD coming out. But that's my old man life too. And the walkway has to be done. Yep. Well, no ice, because I don't want the mailman to slip, or the mail person, sorry.
Is it a man, yeah, Adam?
Yeah. We have... I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I think we have a male woman. Okay. But I think isn't it a male person?
I don't know, no? Adam. I don't work at university anymore.
Sorry.
Well, so we get this establishment of this winter that's actually very gloom, because it's everlasting winter. It means no Christmas. We actually we get that very literally, that the witch has caused the winter, mm-hmm. and part of her magic about this winter is actually to keep Father Christmas out of Narnia. That's very...
To keep Christmas at bay.
Yeah, to make sure that it is always winter, never Christmas. But the children end up being part of a prophecy to bring an end to this winter, right?
Yeah, and think about that. So the White Witch calls herself the Queen of Narnia. The Narnians call Aslan the King of Narnia. They know, the White Witch knows, that if winter comes to an end, think of it sort of like Advent and Christmas, if winter starts coming to an end, that means that Aslan is on the move and the king is returning to Narnia, and that will mean the end of her reign as Queen of Narnia. Mm-hmm. She gets to be queen because of Aslan's absence, not because they're co-ruling. Mm-hmm. If winter comes to an end, or starts coming to an end, that means it's Advent, and the Aslan is on the move, and he's coming.
Right, and when he's back, it'll mean Christmas has arrived.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what ends up happening, as the children hear that Aslan is on the move. Their being there is part of this Advent, part of Aslan on the move. The word starts to spread. As they travel to go meet Aslan, Father Christmas actually comes.
He does.
And he delivers gifts.
Yeah.
Indicating that Aslan has not only been on the move, but he has arrived and Christmas is here. The witch's magic is fading.
Yeah. I think it's worth noting that a lot of people did not like the inclusion of Father Christmas into this story. They thought it was like a... like an illegitimate insertion.
Silly,
of
right?
Yeah, of a silly insertion of another character. Whereas I think
I got goosebumps when I saw it, when I heard him coming in my ears.
And I think that there's something really beautiful and magical about Father Christmas coming because Aslan is on the move. I mean, and basically the way the good news, right, in Narnia starts being revealed is that the beavers report to the children that there are reports that Aslan is on the move. And then they start noticing that the ice is melting and that the river is getting higher. And then they start noticing then Father Christmas arrives, right? And that Christmas is now here. And once Father Christmas arrives, the winter itself starts just...
It becomes spring.
It essentially becomes spring. The children can take off the fur coats that they got out of the wardrobe because they're no longer cold. And spring is here. And they receive their gifts, and their gifts themselves are very... They're not useless gifts. They're very vocational gifts.
The role they are to play in the coming confrontation.
Peter receives the sword of the great high king. Lucy receives both a dagger and a vial, essentially of healing, some kind of magical healing liquid. Susan receives a bow and arrow.
A potion.
And it's interesting that you couldn't say this, I don't think, in our day and age, because...
He tells the girls they're not to fight in the war.
Women are always the heroes in wars now in our stories. But Lewis basically writes it so that Aslan, Father Christmas gives Susan this bow and arrow, and then Aslan tells her.
Father Christmas says that the bow and arrow is only to be used
in
a time of great need, absolute need. And same with the dagger that Lucy gets, that it's only for personal sort of protection. Yeah. And Lucy goes, well, I think I could be brave enough to fight in this war.
There's no doubt about that.
Father Christmas says, wars are always ugliest if women are fighting.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. It's a sort of a level of cruelty being explained that, what has it come to if women and children are
at war,
killing one another? Yeah. It's a particular type of ugliness that exceeds even the devastations of regular war. So that's a very interesting note. And following that, very quickly, you see the children. Now, at this point, the children are essentially in... to two groups, we could say everybody but Edmund and Edmund. And that is because by the time the other children have met Father Christmas, Edmund has betrayed them, has revealed to the witch that all the children are in Narnia and that they're threatening her reign, and that they intend to meet up with Aslan
at the great stone table
to do her in. And he is now actually realized by that point that he has made a grave mistake because he's essentially become her slave.
Yeah, well, she promises him that if he brings his brothers and sisters back, that she will make him a king of Narnia. And it becomes apparent to him once he basically sneaks out of the beaver's house while they're having dinner, and he goes to where she has told him in his previous visit that her house is, and he goes and meets up with her. And from the get-go, she's no longer nice to him, basically. He does this whole thing almost on the promise of Turkish delight and being a king.
Well, and as he's walking to her house, too, what's funny
Turkish
is like...
Turkish delight? What, just one bite?
Just one bite, that's right. One of the greatest fantasies to him is ruling over his brother, Peter, his older brother.
Yeah.
He goes, I will be king. I wonder what Peter will make of that.
Yeah.
You know, he's fantasizing having power over his siblings.
Yep. We should have Josh on the show and he could talk about his fantasies.
Oh, yeah.
In that regard.
But don't you love that the promise from Satan, from the power of evil here, which is at first very appealing, endless Turkish delight, power beyond your imagination, like how quickly it becomes like that deal is actually a deal into slavery.
Yeah, I mean, basically, he's given the promise that he's going to get to rule over his siblings and everyone else. And it's a promise of, it's not a gospel promise. It's a, you'll be able to be their tyrant, not you'll be able to be their good and great high mm-hmm. king, but you'll be able to be their tyrant. And it's quickly turns to him wanting to enslave to him being the slave. And he very quickly understands that this is not, you know, this wasn't the deal he was looking for. Mm-hmm. And as that churns, too, the other children, one of the great things here is that the other children know that they've been betrayed by Edmund. They know this. The beavers tell them this, that what's mm-hmm. going on. And they believe it. It's not like they're in disbelief. They both believe they're being betrayed by Edmund and then still sort of go at nothing but to find Edmund. Mm-hmm. And to rescue him. And I think there's something that's pretty great about that that's often overlooked in here. Once the children meet up with Aslan, they all start heading to this place that we're not really told what the significance is, at least initially. That's the Great Stone Table. And they are heading there, and the witch and the dwarf, right? The dwarf mm-hmm. and Edmund are heading in that direction too.
Yep.
Trying to beat Aslan and the children there.
Yeah, it's and what's kind of funny about the book, and this is a very interesting contrast to Tolkien, is that, you know, Tolkien's books, not only are they for an older audience often, but the way that detail comes in is by taking a pause to, over the course of a page or multiple pages, explain...
Or 20 pages,
the detail of a particular place or a particular person. And those details are an aside from the story often. They're just descriptions. This is more like the Gospel of Mark, where everything happens immediately, and immediately they went, and immediately. Because, you know, just a couple of page turns after the children learn about who Aslan is, they've run into Aslan. Yeah, and immediately they came across the stone table, and there was Aslan, you know. Yeah.
And probably, and not too long after that, too, you get the encounter between Aslan, the children, the witch, the dwarf, and Edmund, where the deal is made to save Edmund.
I think 5 pages later. And the very interesting thing is, you know, Aslan sees the children. He asks where the fourth child is, where Edmund is. They tell him. And Peter confesses to Aslan that
it's his fault.
That too. It's his fault because... Edmund was acting sour, but he continued to be hard on him.
Yeah.
And so that Peter believes his hardness drove him finally away.
Right.
Which is interesting. And then their concern is that Aslan will do something to pursue their brother.
That Aslan will kill their brother, I think, is their fear, because he's a great and terrible lion.
Yeah, but then they ask him, well, can you please do something for Edmund?
Yeah.
And this then leads us to actually the betrayal will lead into Aslan's sacrifice of redemption.
I don't want to like take too much of the magic of people reading it away, but at the end of the day, Aslan sacrifices himself as a we might say propitiation for Edmund, as a substitute for Edmund. He takes his death. The witch makes a claim against Edmund's blood because he's a betrayer. Essentially, and she says that according to the deep magic, the blood of all betrayers belong to me, and you ought to know this, Aslan. And Aslan takes her aside and explains to her the deep magic and that somebody can make a substitute. And he takes on being that substitute. And he's killed at the Great Stone Table. He's shaved and killed at the Great Stone Table as Lucy and Susan watch.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting little scenes in the book, is that Jadis is obviously a wicked, evil tyrant of Narnia at the time of the children's encounter. But her power, her supposed power and her claim over Edmund comes from a law, the deep magic, established by Aslan. So she tries to use Aslan's own law as... the claim to her power and authority.
Yeah. There's a great line in the movie that when I reread it, didn't find in the book, that goes something like, Aslan roars back at Jadis, don't tell me about the deep magic I was there, or the deeper magic I was there when it was written.
That's a very interesting addition.
It's a great addition. Yeah. It's an improvement, honestly. but maybe that's just my theology sort of correcting Lewis a little bit. But it's, I mean, that's essentially what happens.
He explains to her the deep magic,
and then a substitution can be made, and that he'll be willing to be that substitute. And she calls him a fool for that. She calls him the great fool for doing that. So, but little does she know that he knows the deeper magic. That when an innocent gives his life for somebody, that there is a resurrection.
Yeah, that is interesting. The sort of beyond the law, Aslan can't operate beyond just this law of blood.
Yeah, I was listening to Alistair McGrath did a podcast on the C.S. Lewis podcast on The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Adam, you know the young woman that hosts that with him, or is the host of that, but I've forgotten her name.
Yes, I think it's Ruth, right? Ruth.
Yeah.
Johnson, is it? She was at the Fall with me and one of Alistair's star students. Yeah. Very British.
Yeah, well, they both right. are. But she asks him the question, and I want to know what you thought of this. She says, Alistair, don't you think it perplexing that the atonement only applies to Edmund in this case? And I was banging my head on the table. What do you think about that question, Adam? Does the atonement in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe only apply to Edmund? And why would Lewis write it that way, if so?
No, because it reverses everything. It starts to reverse everything, right?
Yeah, I'm with you there. I actually thought it was interesting question.
Yeah, I wonder if when she asks these questions, she's just trying to keep the conversation going. I don't think there's any sort of theological thing going on in the background, but I might be wrong.
Well, he kind of agreed with her, that's the part that I thought was interesting.
I look at this
and I say, oh my gosh, it certainly in the immediate time saves Edmund now, like immediately, right? Boom, Edmund is directly saved by this. Mm-hmm. But so is Peter, has already admitted sin in this whole mm-hmm. matter, and Peter's sin for his part in the betrayal is forgiven, and the atonement itself, like you said, starts to reverse everything. Right, once Aslan is not only atoned for the sins of the Narnians and Edmund and Peter, and on, he raises from the dead the very next day. And he begins to then go give resurrection to all. He goes back to the witch's house, and he starts breathing on all of the animals she's turned into stone. And in his resurrection, he resurrects all those that had been put under bondage to Jadis in her own home. And I just think, I can't see this atonement as just applying to Edmund. I just actually don't see it.
I think in a sense you could sort of take a biblical theme, and you could say that, you know, you could take Paul in the one Adam, in one Adam all fell, and then in Christ the new Adam, right, all are raised. You could apply this same sort of oneness, one to universal concept, that in Edmund is the representative of the one, in one man all fell.
Absolutely.
He is the one who, of the children of Adam, falls, in this case in Narnia, who becomes not just a slave of Jadis, but a willing slave of Jadis.
Well, in Adam's betrayal, they're all betrayers. In Edmund's betrayal, they're all betrayers.
And in Edmund's betrayal, they're all betrayers. And Aslan's return is put at risk. The promise is seemingly put at risk by his betrayal. So I think in that redemption, you could say that our redemption is essentially the redemption of the first Adam, right? Is the redemption of original sin. And so I think you could still have that. And obviously then, by that, all are then redeemed, all is made right, sin is reversed, bondage is turned into freedom at the hand of the resurrected king. So I don't see those having to be exclusive if you're sort of following this biblical theme of, you know, from one all.
Well, yeah. I mean, you could say, did Christ's atonement atone for the sin of Adam and Eve? Yes. Mm-hmm. Does Christ's atonement atone for all of our sin as being children of Adam and Eve? Yes.
And in particular, those are the first people the promise like is made to.
It's like First John, Christ died not just for our sin or that one sin, but died for the sins of the whole world.
Right.
The whole cosmos.
Yeah, everything.
And that's the theme.
Yeah, and Narnia is restored.
Universal atonement.
Eventually, Cair Paravel will be restored.
Yeah.
And they will sit on their thrones there and rule for, you know, a good portion of their sort of teenage and adult lives.
that would be hilarious to be ruling as a king, like as an adult for like who knows how long, and then exit the wardrobe and be a child again. Yeah. Like, where does that wisdom? And then in later books, sort of the you know, they are children and growing children, and the wisdom of Narnia, the farther you get from Narnia, sort of fades. Like, you don't have, you know, you get the impression that they don't have the wisdom of people who ruled for years.
After. Yeah. So I want to do a little bit of what they did in the C.S. Lewis podcast on this and kind of a few questions. Who do you guys think, I think the answer is obvious, but is Lewis's favorite character in this? Like, who, as he writes it, besides Aslan, who's the number one character?
I hesitate to answer because you're obviously the guy who knows all this stuff, right? But I think Lucy.
Yeah, I think it's Lucy.
I think that's been sort of like, sort of attested that Lucy is the favorite in this.
Named after his goddaughter.
Yeah.
Or my dog. Well,
yeah, and just you just get the sense that C.S. Lewis just admires not childishness, but childhood. And even though, you know, his biographers will sometimes make the point that he really didn't show any real sort of, like, that he really wanted his own children or anything like that. But he just seems like a very playful kind of guy, right? And so Lucy is that sort of innocent, playful, naive, not in the negative sense of the term, but naive child.
Yeah,
the story seems to, I mean, it starts with her going in the wardrobe. So, I mean,
And she's in the most of the books as sort of a main character. They made a big deal in the McGrath made a big deal about Susan and why Lewis sort of loses interest in Susan. Mm. And they did a bunch of cultural stuff. I think the answer to that's pretty easy. I think he's drawing a parallel between, in order to enter the kingdom, you're going to need faith like a child, i.e. Lucy, and Susan, who's always just a little too grown up for, you know, for Lewis's liking, who eventually stops believing in Narnia, and we would say becomes apostate, right? And you know, stops trusting in the promises that Aslan told her.
From a there was I listened to one of their overview podcasts a couple weeks ago, and you're right. They took in some modern issues, essentially claiming that the bias against Susan is a type of sexism against grown women that Lewis had. Besides that, there's actually I actually think there's some pragmatics to this. That, like, if we want to narrow down, if Lewis is trying to talk about apostasy ultimately by the end of this book with Susan, could any of the other children, based on the roles that they played, done that without interrupting something else? I don't think you can do that with Edmund, right? He's been redeemed to the extent of the betrayer, that if you have the betrayer fall away, it sort of undoes what Aslan does in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Peter is sort of, through all of his appearances, the stalwart leader.
And quickly becomes too old to enter Narnia.
Yeah. Quickly becomes,
but always
too
believes
old,
in it.
Always believes in it, and has sort of a very, like, he makes an assertion about who Aslan is quickly after the encounter with the beavers, after hearing about Aslan, fights alongside him in those assertions, rules as his high king, Lucy has that childlike faith. She's that representative of childlike faith. That leaves you with one child to work with in this original.
Well, and he sets up from encounter. The beginning that Susan is a little too grown up.
Yeah.
Because that's even what Edmund tells her. And, you know, it's at one point that stop acting like an adult.
So
you're not an adult.
You know, is it sexism? I mean, everything is, but probably not the main reason. There's a he only had so many children to work with from the beginning to end of somebody hearing and falling away.
Why? Yeah, I guess maybe I'm stuck in my own sort of milieu, as they might say. But I it makes total sense to me. It's always based on the fact that she just stops believing, even when the other children still believe and are still telling her about it. Oh, those are just stories we had as children. Blah, 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 pish posh.
Well, it's interesting because as a standalone book, you can see the Christian themes, but you could also make comparisons to like World War II and the Blitz, right? You could call the Blitz always winter, right? Yeah. Every night in Narnia, one of the things they emphasize is that it snows again during the winter. Well, the Blitz was taking place often at night.
It's
snowing. It's snowing again, right? Yeah. Everybody has to find shelter. It's not going to be safe to travel. You know, Lewis even makes comparison, like brief comparisons to the Nazis and the witch in there. So there, you know, you could even do some of this, that there is a bit of, you know, the fantasy of good and evil in the world wars as well, which was a, you know, sort of common patriotism. So.
Well, anything else to say on Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe? I mean, it's a great redemption story. It kind of takes, one of the things I like about it is it kind of takes Advent, Christmas, Good Friday, and Easter and sticks it in a really compact package and hands it to you.
Yeah.
So, I think that's actually pretty great that somebody can do that in an engaging children's novel. Is, you know, attest to his talent, honestly.
Yeah. I think some of it works because he uses... Oh, go ahead, Adam.
Well, I was a sort of historical question for you, Scott. How long did it take him to write this story, do you think? I know we don't know exactly, but...
There's some debate on it. I think the last thing I heard Michael Ward say... The last thing I heard Michael Ward say was that they think it was probably 3 years from the time he started until it was published. But that once he got going on it, they think that each one in the in-between was probably about a year, year and a half of writing.
Okay.
Now, you can write a
lot. It's interesting because I know you've read... Sure. Especially if you're not working like a normal sort of 9-to-5 type of job. If you're... You know, in Oxford, Don, they have, you know, they obviously have schedules, but they live, and purposely so, a life of leisure. You know, they're there to think great thoughts and write
but like classical
papers,
classical
and so
leisure,
forth.
Not like binging Netflix episodes.
Yeah, they're not playing right or Netflix and chilling. I wonder. You know, I know you and I have talked about this in years past, not on the podcast or anything, but the process of writing, and that he could just put together a story like this that is so cohesive. You know, there's not a whole lot of loose ends. You know, it's a very, and he could just do this in that amount of time, then produce all the volumes in the Chronicles of Narnia in, what, a decade's time, I think it is, a little less than a decade.
Yeah.
It's just, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, while doing other stuff too, and while writing other things too.
Well, yeah, with a teaching load and public appearances and
one of the reasons they have a hard time nailing down how long it actually took him is because Michael Ward says he was famous for throwing away his rough drafts of things that he wouldn't like save in a file and refer back to them, that if he wrote it and he read it and he didn't like it, he'd crumble it up, throw it in the can and rewrite the whole chapter again.
Yeah. I get that a little bit.
Oh,
I mean, I don't do it, but I get it. I think, you know, just as a closing, one of the reasons I think he can pull off the books being so short yet deep and descriptive is he's working with things you might know. So not only that Christian redemptive narrative, but like you don't need 5 pages to describe what an older or younger brother and sister are and how they interact, because you're dealing with a category that a lot of people understand, right? Like how kids of that age can be cruel to each other, right? Like you can just say it and people know, instantly what that looks like and things like that, or sort of the leading older brother type thing, the strong and ferocious nature of a lion, right? Those types of things are like, he drives that point home, but he doesn't have to do it in pages and pages, because he can tell you that the lion is big, strong, powerful, scary, and has a mane, and you know exactly what you're looking at.
Or even the paws, and describe the paws. No, I do think it's classic work. I think it will endure. Will people be reading it in 300 years? My answer to that would be, I certainly hope so. I'm not necessarily confident that people will even be reading classics in 300 years, the way things are going, but I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, guys, Merry Christmas from the Thinking Fellows podcast. Thank you for joining us on this episode. I didn't put a spoiler alert at the beginning. I have a hard time doing that with things this old. Because I assume that a lot of our readership is at least watch the movies, if not read the books. But if you haven't read the books and you got a little spoiled on the endings and such as we were talking about it, the next episode, it may be a good idea, which will be a week from now, to try and finish the next book.
So, yeah, no, I think that in the ones that are to come, we should sort of just answer questions about the books rather than recap them so that people can read them. I think you're safe with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that most people that are listening to this have either read it and or seen the movie. But the further down the pike you get with these books, the further away you're going to get from knowing or having a decent amount of knowledge that people have actually encountered the real material. And I mean, and I think that goes back to Adam's questions. I don't know how much money they made on the movies. Well, it seems like they made a good amount of money on Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe because everybody loves it. And the more into it they went, the less money they made, because people weren't just not as familiar with the stories and not as interested in seeing them, which is a shame. But I think the way that it goes, I was going to say, if this is our Merry Christmas episode, I think it'd be worth saying that Merry Christmas, because of Christ in our world, Christmas, it's always Christmas and never this long-suffering winter.
Yeah, always Christmas, never winter. Here. Yes, Merry Christmas. And for those of you who, we mentioned the order last episode, but maybe you missed last episode, the next book we will be doing is Prince Caspian.
Correct.
Next Tuesday.
Which means you're not going to get to the creation story with us until second to last.
That's fine. Fine by me. So, hey, thank you for listening to this episode. Thank you for your support of the Thinking Fellows podcast. We will catch you next week. Bye.